nor interested in knowing whether or not his senior advisor was involved. It immediately prompted questions about how the president knew. The follow-up had been easier to brush off in the gaggle. In the on-camera briefing, I danced around the question a little before repeating a line I used at times. We are not in the habit of discussing conversations the president has with his senior advisors. In response to a question from Dana Bash of CNN about why the president was not looking at this as an ethical matter, since he'd committed himself as a candidate to restoring honor and integrity to the White House, I replied, "The president has set high standards, the highest of standards for people in his administration. He's made it very clear to people in his administration that he expects them to adhere to the highest standards of conduct. If anyone in this administration were involved in it, they would no longer be in this administration." Those last words would get plenty of media play over the next few years, particularly as important information came to light. With the president's approval and his oft-stated commitment to honor and integrity embedded in my mind, I could not have been more confident in what I said. When he announced that he was running for president in June 1999, Bush had said, "We will show that politics, after a time of tarnished ideals, can be higher and better. We will give our country a fresh start after a season of cynicism." On January 22, 2001, our first full day in office, the president had reminded all of us in his administration at the public swearing-in ceremony for senior White House staff to adhere to the high standards that come with high office and avoid even the appearance of problems. His commitment to high ethical standards had made many of us who served proud to answer the call to be a part of his team. We believe this president was uncompromisingly committed to something better than what Americans had seen from some elected leaders. And he had established his reputation in part on saying what he meant and doing what he said. Now, 2.5 years later, the question of whether the administration still adhered to those high standards was on everybody's mind. 45 minutes after it began, the briefing was over. It was time for me to come down from the adrenaline rush of a contentious session and enjoy the moment. The feedback in the post-briefing critique with my deputies and assistants was very positive. The official White House transcript was 32 pages long. The first 24 were about the leak investigation. More than 110 questions and 33 and a half minutes elapsed before we turned to the topics other than the leak investigation. I received many accolades that afternoon for the way I conducted the briefing under fire. Praise came from colleagues in the White House and the administration, and even a number of White House reporters. Bill Plant, a cynical veteran CBS News White House correspondent, even said to me, "I've seen a lot of press secretaries in tough spots. That was not easy today. I just wanted to say, you did a good job." When I saw the president later in the day, he similarly said, "Good job today." I expressed appreciation, not knowing whether he had actually caught any of the briefing or was simply told by my colleagues on the senior staff that I'd held my own. I don't know whether this was my finest performance in the briefing room, but I felt pretty good about it, and even better after receiving kind words throughout the day. At least I'd shown that I was ready to do my part to help navigate the Bush White House through the troubled waters to re-election. For the second night in a row, the network newscast all headlined their broadcast with the leak story, as did the morning shows and newspapers the following day. It wouldn't be the last time. Like the war at the root of the scandal, it was not going away anytime soon. Chapter 11. Betting the Presidency. The leak episode was just one offshoot of Bush's most consequential decision and the predominant issue in Washington as I assumed my new responsibilities as White House Press Secretary, the Iraq War. Many other aspects of the war would come into play over the remainder of Bush's first term, especially in the run-up to Election Day. Throughout the second half of 2003 and into 2004, with the Iraq occupation gradually becoming more controversial, Democrats saw an opening for attacking Bush's credibility, judgment, and competence. Had the president and his team exaggerated or distorted the intelligence on WMD to deliberately mislead the nation to war? How was the war in Iraq part of the war on terror when it had no connection to 9/11 and no relationship with Al-Qaeda? Why did Bush rush to war with no plan to win the peace? How did the administration miscalculate the strength of the insurgency so badly? Either Bush and his advisors had distorted the truth, in which case they were less than honest, or they had failed to recognize the truth in a rush to topple Saddam Hussein, in which case they were less than competent. In either case, the president appeared vulnerable. It was quite a change from the period right after the 2002 midterms, when Bush had been riding high in the opinion polls, and many experts foresaw an easy re-election bid. The Washington media were enlivened and energized by the prospect of a hotly contested political duel. With the president's credibility being questioned, an increasingly costly war, and an economic recovery yet to show any job creation, his popularity was beginning to sag, and the number of Americans who viewed him unfavorably was growing. This, in turn, affected the tenor of media coverage, a common occurrence in the era of the permanent campaign. When a president is up in the polls, he tends to be lionized in the media. When he is down or trending downward, he tends to be attacked. And in the case of George W. Bush, the media had more reason than usual to change its tune in harmony with public opinion. Having failed to be sufficiently skeptical and assertive in the lead-up to war, they would seek to remedy their shortcomings by challenging a now vulnerable president ever more aggressively. Bush and those of us on his team remained confident. We still boasted the bully pulpit of the White House, a formidable campaign machine headed by the famous and widely feared Karl Rove, an energized Republican base, and a national network of supporters among cable news commentators, newspaper pundits, and radio talk show hosts who could be counted on to defend the president. Every political calculation would be made within the context of the overall campaign strategy, which was calculated to ensure that national security, especially the war on terrorism, Bush's perceived strength, would remain at the core of the public debate. What's more, even as Bush's popularity sagged, the president and his political team recalled the old truth that you can't beat somebody with nobody. Bush was still a formidable somebody, while the Democrats had yet to settle on a nominee for 2004, a somebody with weaknesses and vulnerabilities of his own. As soon as the Democratic opponent was named, Karl Rove would direct the assault on him, drawing contrast in ways that would be favorable to the president and unfavorable to the challenger. As everyone knew, few, if any, in politics could do it better. The president would firmly stand his ground on Iraq. There would be no give on his part about the necessity of war. There would be no second-guessing the decision. There would be no doubting the eventual outcome. Changing the tone and ending the partisan warfare in Washington was no longer a consideration. As far as the spirited political competitor Bush was concerned, it was a time to stand firm and starkly clarify the choice facing the American people ahead of the coming election. His presidency was on the line. His legacy was at stake. He would bet it all on Iraq. In retrospect, this was the defining period for Bush's presidency, and it revealed much about him as a leader. As press secretary, I was participating regularly in most of the president's key meetings, policy deliberations, congressional outreach, cabinet meetings, and world leader visits. As a Texas loyalist, I was a trusted member of the president's senior-most team of advisors, frequently conferring with him and a select group of insiders that included Card, Rove, Rice, and Bartlett. World leader meetings at the White House usually included small delegations, equal in number, representing each side. The president's delegation would typically include the U.S. ambassador to the country in question, the national security advisor, the secretary of state, or one of his deputies or assistants, an NSC director for the region, the vice president's chief of staff, or national security point person, if not Cheney himself, and the press secretary. The Secretary of Defense would sometimes attend, too. In the Oval, Bush and the foreign leader would sit in the light blue and gold-striped chairs in front of the fireplace. Our delegation would sit to Bush's left, usually three on the couch, followed by two or three in chairs. The visiting delegation would be situated similarly on the other side of the room. Bush's strategic vision of changing the Middle East by establishing a free and democratic Iraq was one he emphasized in virtually every world leader meeting. These meetings, early in my tenure as press secretary, underscored, for me, that Bush's thinking on democratic transformation was the driving reason for our invasion of Iraq. It was a strategic mission much more grandiose than the one he emphasized publicly of eliminating a grave and gathering danger in Iraq. As the chances of uncovering WMD in Iraq dwindled, the dream of transforming the region became more and more prominent in the president's rhetoric and mine. The day before I officially assumed my duties as press secretary, I attended the president's meeting in the Oval with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. It started with a discussion about the president's recent trip to Africa and the unprecedented support the United States was offering that beleaguered continent, including HIV/AIDS relief, expanding trade, combating hunger, and supporting African-led peacekeeping efforts in areas of civil unrest. Then the conversation turned to Iraq, a topic fraught with tension. Before the invasion, Annan had urged Bush not to act without UN support, advice that Bush had rejected. The president viewed Annan as a weak leader who epitomized the ineffectual body he served. Ever the soft-spoken, low-key diplomat, Annan did not inspire confidence in the assertive, action-oriented, results-centered Bush. Nevertheless, their relationship was cordial and respectful. The president thanked Annan for sending the widely respected special representative, Sergio Vieira de Mello, to help in Iraq's transition. Bush and his foreign policy team felt it was important to have a UN presence in Baghdad. The more the United Nations and other countries were involved in Iraq, including countries that had opposed the original decision to go to war, the lighter the burden for the United States. Of course, this position was a bit of a contradiction, given the president's willingness to preemptively wage war without the explicit approval of the UN, though he viewed Security Council Resolution 1441 as providing him authority to do so. Hence, Bush's delicate encouragement for the UN in Iraq, and his constant diplomatic niceties with Annan and other skeptical leaders, both in private and in public. Tragically, Vieira de Mello was killed on August 19, 2003, in a terrorist bombing that targeted the Canal Hotel in Baghdad, which had been used as the UN's local headquarters since 1991. 21 other staff members were killed at the same time. As a result, the UN dramatically reduced its involvement and presence in Baghdad for the immediate future. In speaking with Annan, Bush emphasized his view that a free, democratic Iraq was essential to peace in the Middle East. He acknowledged that the situation there was tough going, but asserted that the coalition was slowly getting the upper hand. He said he felt that Paul Bremer was doing a hell of a job in overseeing the early days of Iraq's fledgling democratic transition. Annan stressed the need to show that there was a light at the end of the tunnel to the American-run Coalition Provisional Authority led by Bremer, and called the just-announced Iraqi Governing Council, a broadly representative body appointed by the CPA, a very positive step toward putting Iraq on the path toward sovereignty. The Bush themes would become increasingly familiar to me as I attended world leader meetings in my new role as press secretary. My first day in my new post, the president met with Prime Minister Vladimir Spidla of the Czech Republic. Bush began by thanking the prime minister for his strong support in the face of tough criticism on Iraq, and let him know his administration would not forget his strong leadership. This was typical of the president, I would learn. He tended to judge the character and strength of a world leader more favorably if he had supported the decision to invade Iraq. Spidla, like some other leaders who had lived under communist rule, shared Bush's passion for freedom and stood firmly with him on Iraq. Spidla said he believed what the United States was doing in Iraq would help bring peace and stability to the Middle East. "You make a very important point," Bush responded. "It's important to keep in mind the big picture, our vision. The action we took in Iraq will bring peace and stability. I truly believe a free and peaceful Iraq will have a long-term effect on the Middle East. Freedom is powerful." In late October 2003, the president visited Canberra, Australia, following the Asian-Pacific Economic Summit in Bangkok, Thailand, with stops in Japan, Singapore, and Indonesia. Bush met with Prime Minister John Howard, a good ally and friend. "I attended the meeting in the Cabinet Room at Parliament House. Howard, despite deep division among Australians, had stood strongly behind Bush's decision to topple Saddam Hussein, persuading the Australian Parliament to commit troops in support of the American-led invasion and occupation." Bush and Howard, as usual in such a meeting, discussed a number of pressing priorities, including Iraq and transformation of the Middle East. "Thank you for being tough," Bush said to Howard, "and for your friendship. It is important to have the courage to do what is right. You've done that, John. Iraq will change the Middle East. Iran will change because of what we are doing in Iraq." Later in the meeting, one of Howard's advisors asked Bush if he thought Islamic cultures could really adopt democracy. "I think so over time," Bush replied. I believe Iraq is the place that will help make it happen. It will evolve into a democratic free country like Turkey or like Bahrain is moving to. I believe freedom is the deepest hope of every human heart, Bush added. I think there are enough Muslim leaders committed to freedom to move Islamic states in that direction. I believe it is going to happen. In early November, the president welcomed Prime Minister Ranil Wickremasinghe of Sri Lanka to the White House. Bush began by thanking the prime minister for standing strong on Iraq at the most recent UN General Assembly meeting in September. Ranil had stated that the United States had no choice but to intervene militarily, leading to heavy criticism of him in the media at home. The decisions I made were for the security concerns of America, Bush stated. I also believe free societies are peaceful societies. He added that by dealing with Saddam Hussein, other rogue nations like North Korea knew how serious the United States was about addressing threats. 50 years from now, people will say thanks for what we are doing in Iraq, Bush said. You have stood rock solid in the face of critics. I assure you one thing, a free and peaceful Iraq will help achieve peace in the Middle East. The consistency and prominence of the president's rhetoric in these meetings with foreign leaders was striking. It convinced me of the sincerity of his passion for the idea of implanting democracy coercively as a way of bringing peace to the Middle East. One could question the wisdom or the practicality of this plan, but not the genuineness of the personal vision that drove it. At the time, it was something powerful and hopeful I could embrace, which helped quell the uncertainties I harbored about the original decision. Communicating with the American people about the situation in Iraq was more challenging. Having been sold on the necessity of war by the argument that Saddam represented a direct and growing threat to the region, the United States, and the world, the public and the media were growing more and more skeptical as the summer wore on and no WMD were found. So we felt relieved near the end of July when the killing of Uday and Qusay Hussein, the ruthless and much-hated sons of the dictator, afforded us a brief change of focus in the media coverage. It came just in time for the president's usual midsummer news conference. This was an event typically held at the end of July, just before the president and some of us on his team headed to Crawford, Texas, for the month of August. It would be Bush's first formal news conference since the invasion. The tone set by the president in discussing Iraq was always something we, his team of advisors, struggled to properly calibrate. We didn't want him to sound pessimistic, of course, but we also didn't want him to sound disconnected from the painful reality on the ground being reported by the media. With events in Iraq changing daily and unpredictably, and with frequent attacks occurring against American troops, despite the president's declaration in May that major combat operations had ended, this was a tricky line to walk. In preparing for the July press conference, we agreed that Bush would have to accept responsibility for the flawed 16 words in the State of the Union address. This would get headline attention since it was news, but we hoped we could also draw attention to some of the positive developments of recent weeks in Iraq. The president preferred a more informal briefing before the press conference. With the help of my deputy press secretaries, I would prepare questions and suggest responses so Bush could review them the evening before. Communications Director Dan Bartlett would focus on broader message points Bush should emphasize and work with the speechwriting team to get the opening statement down. There would usually be two sessions the day of the news conference where we could go through likely questions. The first would be in the Oval shortly after the president arrived or after his morning intelligence briefings. It tended to be shorter, in the 20 to 30 minute range, while the final one, closer to the scheduled time of the news conference in the Oval, would be a half hour to 45 minutes. Andy Card, Condi Rice, and Karl Rove usually attended at least one of the sessions. Bush would sit at his desk for these murder board sessions, where we'd throw the tough or killer questions at him. Bush liked bringing a little levity to the sessions, ridiculing some questions with playful responses he would never utter in public. It was a way for him to relax and get his mind focused, in much the same way that a world-class athlete might ease nervousness ahead of a crucial contest. When the game began, the president was ready. One by one, he hit all the points he'd planned to cover. On Iraq, he pointed to progress while acknowledging difficulties and calling for patience. Most of Iraq was growing more peaceful, he noted, although remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime, joined by terrorists and criminals, were making a last attempt to frighten the Iraqi people and undermine the resolve of the coalition. The rise of a free and peaceful Iraq, Bush emphasized, is critical to the stability of the Middle East, and a stable Middle East is critical to the security of the American people. The success of a free Iraq will also demonstrate to other countries in that region that national prosperity and dignity are found in representative government and free institutions. They are not found in tyranny, resentment, and support of terrorism. As freedom advances in the Middle East, those societies will be less likely to produce ideologies of hatred and produce recruits for terror. Bush alluded to the killing of Uday and Qusay, saying, as the blanket of fear is lifted, as Iraqis gain confidence that the former regime is gone forever, we will gain more cooperation in our search for the truth in Iraq. And he expressed his confidence that the truth about WMD would confirm his decision to go to war. We know that Saddam Hussein produced and possessed chemical and biological weapons, and has used chemical weapons. We know that. He also spent years hiding his weapons of mass destruction programs from the world. We now have teams of investigators who are hard at work to uncover the truth. Bush also touched on some other issues Americans were concerned about, remembering that his father's re-election campaign had faltered in large part because of his apparent indifference to people's economic woes. It's the economy, stupid. And thinking about the current criticism of a jobless recovery, Bush made a point of emphasizing his administration's economic accomplishments in the form of additional stimulus for taxpayers and small businesses. And for the first time, he signaled openness to the idea of a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage, a hot-button topic for Christian conservative leaders. The president had done a good job, we felt, but in the Washington game, once the press senses a politician is on the defensive, a peculiar quirk in the rules rears its head. The referees and the opposing team can appear indistinguishable. The media headlines coming out of the news conference focused on Bush's shrinking credibility, noting his denials on the charge of having oversold his case for war in Iraq. As the old political adage says, when you're defending, you're losing, and that was the uncomfortable spot Bush now found himself caught in. NBC News followed its coverage of the news conference with updated poll numbers showing that the president's approval rating had dropped from 71% in April to 56% now, while his disapproval rating had risen from 23% to 38% over the same period. On the other hand, he still held strong on the war on terrorism, with 66% approving of his handling of it, and 56% said that they felt the Democratic attacks on Bush were just plain politics. Still, the trends weren't good. If problems in Iraq continued to fester, and particularly if the human and financial cost continued to soar and the chief rationale for the war continued to unravel, it was only a matter of time before Americans began to abandon the war in droves, and with it, the administration that had staked its credibility on that war. During that summer, we had not yet abandoned hope of finding WMD. David Kaye, a respected scientist and experienced weapons inspector, provided some assurance to us privately and publicly that there was every reason to believe that damning evidence of Saddam's quest for WMD would eventually be uncovered in Iraq. Kaye headed the Iraq Survey Group, a 1,400-plus person fact-finding mission set up by the Pentagon and the CIA to search for WMD in Iraq. Based on what we were being told, we sensed that while large stockpiles were unlikely to be discovered, some small stocks of chemical or biological weapons still might be found, along with evidence of WMD research and development programs. If that happened, it would greatly weaken Democratic attacks asserting that the Bush administration had exaggerated the threat or deliberately misled the American people to sell war. NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw interviewed Kaye in mid-July about the effort. He introduced the interview by saying, Kaye, a cautious professional who is well aware of the political pressure, is confident he can make the case against Saddam Hussein on WMD. Kaye then told Brokaw that within 6 months, he expected to find a substantial body of evidence to demonstrate that Saddam had a WMD program. Kaye's optimism provided some comfort to us in the White House, false comfort as it turned out. But at the time, his ongoing efforts allowed us in the administration to fend off questions about the intelligence used to justify war. Lacking evidence to support what we'd confidently convinced ourselves to believe, we could still defer or evade getting drawn into acknowledging any definitive judgments about the rationale while the Iraq Survey Group continued its work. In early October, Kay released an interim progress report. He cautioned that it was still too early to reach final conclusions. The study group had discovered dozens of WMD program-related activities, but no weapons of mass destruction. We quickly pounced on the report as proof that Saddam Hussein had been in material breach of Resolution 1441, which had given him one final opportunity to comply with UN disarmament demands or face serious consequences. The report showed that the president had been right to eliminate the danger his regime posed to the world, as Colin Powell stated. Our talking point had now shifted from focusing on WMD to WMD programs, though if asked, we would say we continued to believe weapons would eventually be found. War critics and some Democrats used the Kay report to again raise the possibility that the administration had at a minimum hyped the WMD threat from Iraq. It was a theme that Diane Sawyer pressed Bush to address during an interview at the White House a couple of months later in December 2003. Citing a poll showing that 50% of Americans believed the administration had exaggerated the evidence in the build-up to war, Sawyer asked if the president felt that they were wrong or misguided. Bush declined to take the bait. He said the intelligence had been sound and that there was no doubt that Saddam Hussein was a threat. Sawyer sought to pin him down, saying that before the war, he and others had asserted there was no doubt that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The president returned to his oft-repeated assertion that he'd made the right decision regardless of the presence or absence of WMD. Saddam Hussein was a danger and the world is better off because we got rid of him, he said. Sawyer pressed again, focusing on the distinction between WMD and WMD programs. The administration, she pointed out, had previously asserted that there were weapons of mass destruction, as opposed to the possibility that he could move to acquire those weapons still. Bush's response was telling, much more so than I stopped to contemplate at the time. So what's the difference? Bush asked. After all, if Saddam had acquired WMD, he would still have been a danger. Bush declined to say whether the administration could have been more precise in laying out the evidence prior to the war and dismissed criticism that it might have been misleading. He asserted again that everyone had seen the same intelligence and come to the same conclusion. Saddam Hussein was a threat that needed to be dealt with. The president's response received quite a bit of media attention and criticism from Democrats, some of whom noted that the rationale had been that the Iraqi regime posed an urgent threat that required preemptive action. But at the time, it did not have an immediate negative impact on public opinion. Just before Sawyer's interview, our troops had captured Saddam Hussein, pulling him out of the spider hole in which he'd hidden. The good news gave us a temporary bump in support for the war. Still, the narrative of exaggeration or deliberate deception had been established at least as far back as the 16 words controversy. Our lack of candor and slowness in doing something to address the problem, even by investigating why it was wrong, only allowed it to take hold. The president was right that virtually everyone had the same intelligence to review and believed Saddam Hussein was a danger. But he was the one who rapidly pushed the country toward war, based on the way his advisors packaged the intelligence to sound more certain, grave, and urgent than it was turning out to be. Because of our continuing lack of openness and forthrightness about the case for war, the president was boxing himself in, deepening suspicion and fueling partisan combat. It allowed some critics and partisan Democrats to raise questions and insinuate deliberate deception about how Bush's team of policymakers had used intelligence to sell the war. But since we avoided discussing it or fully examining the truth of how the case was made, we could only counterattack by questioning, though not completely dispelling, the honesty or fairness of their arguments, so the verbal warfare would only accelerate. The media in such an instance might fairly be accused of overemphasizing the controversy and allowing deceitful attacks against us to receive too much attention. But our spin and evasion were leaving lingering questions unaddressed and opening the administration to growing criticism. It was a narrative that could only be changed through candor and a willingness to accept some short-term political pain by acknowledging our own mistakes. In hindsight, we missed our opportunity to put that narrative to rest for good. To do so, the president would have had to fully investigate the selling of the war, openly accept responsibility, and then hold top people accountable. Instead, the president was on a course that would ultimately lead to a much heavier price being paid in terms of his credibility and legacy. That course led in January 2004 to another major setback in the struggle for public support. David Kaye resigned as head of the Iraq Survey Group that month and testified before Congress that there were no WMD stockpiles to be found. "It turns out we were all wrong, probably in my judgment," Kaye stated. Along with prominent Democrats, Kaye called for an independent, outside inquiry into the apparent failure of U.S. intelligence. But Kaye stated he did not believe the administration had pressured intelligence analysts to exaggerate the threat. In the summer of 2004, the Senate Intelligence Committee would reach similar conclusions, stating that policymakers had been misled by faulty intelligence and putting off any examination of how the intelligence was used by policymakers. Bush and his advisors feared outside investigations. However, as momentum built for yet another independent probe, we saw the benefit of acting quickly and on our terms. Bush soon announced the creation of a bipartisan independent commission to look into our intelligence on WMD, including Iraq. Its members were appointed by the president and its scope set by his team. It would not include looking at how the intelligence had been used to make the case for war. That was something Bush and his top advisors sought to avoid, concerned at a minimum, particularly in an election year, that it would prove politically fatal. They were willing to allow things to become more politicized, some considering it a battle that could be fought to a draw or even used to motivate the base, and believed that the short-term political cost could be minimized. In Bush's mind, how the case for war had been made scarcely mattered. What mattered now was the policy and showing success. The public tends to be more forgiving when the results are promising. If the policy was right and the selling of the policy could be justified at the time, then any difference between the two mattered little. In this view, governing successfully in Washington is about winning public opinion and getting positive results. To this day, the president seems unbothered by the disconnect between the chief rationale for war and the driving motivation behind it, and unconcerned about how the case was packaged. The policy is the right one, and history will judge it so, once a free Iraq is firmly in place and the Middle East begins to become more democratic. Bush clung to the same belief during an interview with Tim Russert of NBC News in early February 2004. The Meet the Press host asked, "In light of not finding the weapons of mass destruction, do you believe the war in Iraq is a war of choice or a war of necessity?" The president said, "That's an interesting question. Please elaborate on that a little bit. A war of choice or a war of necessity?" "It's a war of necessity. In my judgment, we had no choice when we look at the intelligence I looked at that says the man was a threat." I remember talking to the president about this question following the interview. He seemed puzzled and asked me what Russert was getting at with the question. This, in turn, puzzled me. Surely this distinction between a necessary, unavoidable war and a war that the United States could have avoided but chose to wage was an obvious one that Bush must have thought about in the months before the invasion. Evidently, it wasn't obvious to the president, nor did his national security team make sure it was. He set the policy early on, and then his team focused his attention on how to sell it. It strikes me today as an indication of his lack of inquisitiveness and his detrimental resistance to reflection, something his advisors needed to compensate for better than they did. Most objective observers today would say that in 2003, there was no urgent need to address the threat posed by Saddam with a large-scale invasion, and therefore the war was not necessary. But this is a question President Bush seems not to want to grapple with. I sat stone-faced and motionless in the elegant White House East Room, trying hard not to show any outward concern in front of the assembled inquisitors. But I could feel the muscles in my body tensing up as I listened to the president's tortured response to a straightforward question. It was near the end of a primetime press conference in April 2004. The president had called on John Dickerson, a White House correspondent for Time magazine. Having covered Bush since the 2000 campaign, Dickerson was a comfortingly familiar face. Risk-averse by nature, the president hesitated to call on reporters he did not recognize, preferring to stick largely to the recommended names highlighted with a Sharpie on the seating chart resting on the podium. The list always included the most prominent journalists from the major networks, wire services, and newspapers, as well as at least one radio and one news magazine reporter. The advantage of this approach was that the questions from traditional media correspondents predictably focused on the week's current headlines. Rarely was a question asked that we hadn't prepared the president for ahead of time. Bush was hardly ever thrown completely off his game, unable to either fall back on his broad philosophical views or find a way to segue to a few familiar talking points he could recite in his sleep. This night, I'd highlighted the name of a different news magazine correspondent, primarily because Dickerson had been called on more recently. But I also knew his probingly clever questions had a way of knocking the president off script. The result might be to change the next day's news coverage from what we sought the focus to be, or, even worse yet, create some actual news. For example, in one previous press conference, Dickerson had asked the president about whether he thought Muslims worshiped the same God as Christians. In another, he'd asked whether he agreed with many of his supporters that homosexuality is immoral. These controversial social topics were too far outside the president's comfort zone to elicit expansive public comment. When Bush had responded by saying that, yes, Muslims worship the same God as Christians, some evangelical leaders were dismayed. And when he answered the question about homosexuality by referring to tolerance for all individuals, his initial remark that we're all sinners caused some critics on the left to cry foul, because Bush was implying that homosexuality was sinful. But Dickerson had a disarmingly, easygoing, down-to-earth manner, not unlike the president's, and this made Bush partial to him. His question would be the next-to-last one asked, and it was deceptively simple. "Thank you, Mr. President," the clean-cut, golden-haired reporter began, as he was handed the wireless microphone and rose to ask his question. "In the last campaign, you were asked a question about the biggest mistake you'd made in your life, and you used to like to joke that it was trading Sammy Sosa. You've looked back before 9/11 for what mistakes might have been made. After 9/11, what would your biggest mistake be, would you say, and what lessons have you learned from it?" The president began with a lighthearted quip. "I wish you would have given me this written question ahead of time so I could plan for it," the assembled reporters chuckled. "John, I'm sure historians will look back and say, gosh, he could have done it better this way or that way. You know, I'm sure something will pop into my head here in the midst of this press conference, with all the pressure of trying to come up with an answer, but it hadn't yet." His response was followed by an agonizingly long pause. "Have you ever experienced seconds that felt like minutes? 100 thoughts flowed through my brain while that terrible silence hung embarrassingly in the air. I found myself thinking, come on, sir, this one is not difficult. Just say something like, I'm sure I've made plenty of mistakes and history will judge them, but I've got a job to do, and while some would like me to look backward, you can even use your favorite expression, navel gaze. I believe it's important to keep looking forward, thinking about the important objectives we're trying to accomplish. That's what the American people expect me to do, and that's what I intend to do." The assembled reporters stirred uneasily in their seats as the silence continued. When someone is struggling in public, everyone around feels uncomfortable. No American wants to see our president look awkward or embarrassed on a national platform. Yet that is what we were witnessing now. As President Bush continued to agonize over a response, I blamed myself. Why didn't we throw that one at him in the murder board session beforehand? We used it before, without specifying after 9/11. It's such an obvious one. What is wrong with me? But then a counter-reaction kicked in. Wait a second. We're talking about the president of the United States here. He didn't get to be president without being able to bat down a simple question. We've talked about mistakes. We've talked about 9/11. We've talked about the invasion of Iraq. Why can't he pull up some of those talking points? And all the while, as the debate raged in my head, the president continued to stumble, while I wanted desperately to scream out an answer for him. The pauses lasted only a few seconds, but at the time, it seemed much longer than that. Finally, the president came out with a rambling, rather incoherent, ultimately unsatisfying response to Dickerson's question. "I would have gone into Afghanistan the way we went into Afghanistan. Even knowing what I know today about the stockpiles of weapons, I still would have called upon the world to deal with Saddam Hussein. See, I happen to believe that we'll find out the truth on the weapons. That's why we've sent up the independent commission." I look forward to hearing the truth, exactly where they are. They could still be there. They could be hidden, like the 50 tons of mustard gas in a turkey farm. One of the things that UN Arms Inspector Charlie Dulfolk talked about was that he was surprised at the level of intimidation he found amongst people who should know about weapons, and their fear of talking about them because they don't want to be killed. There's a terror still in the soul of some of the people in Iraq. They're worried about getting killed, and therefore they're not going to talk. But it will all settle out, John. We'll find out the truth about the weapons at some point in time. However, the fact that he had the capacity to make them bothers me today, just like it would have bothered me then. He's a dangerous man. He's a man who actually not only had weapons of mass destruction, the reason I can say that with certainty is because he used them, and I have no doubt in my mind that he would like to have inflicted harm or paid people to inflict harm or trained people to inflict harm on America because he hated us. I don't want to sound like I've made no mistakes. I'm confident I have. I just haven't. You just put me under the spot here, and maybe I'm not as quick on my feet as I should be in coming up with one. In desperation, he turned and called for another question, relief obvious on his features as he said, "Yes, Ann." Watching Bush struggle with the simple question, I sensed, as many others in the room did, that he was hung up on what he thought the press still sought to extract from him, an acknowledgement, 1 year after the fact, that his decision to go into Iraq was a mistake. That's why, unwilling to make any such admission, his response had morphed into yet another justification of the invasion, even though this was exactly the opposite of what Dickerson had asked. As we were walking out of the East Room at the end of the press conference and moving briskly to catch up with the president, Dan Bartlett and I conversed in muted tones. We both agreed that the Dickerson response had not gone well. The president, his tie now loosened, was waiting for us just inside the main entrance to the unlit state dining room. The only light came from the cracks of the sliding doors, the two openings to the dimly lit red room and the opening to the old family dining room nearby. Dan and I knew the drill. It was the president's bedtime, and he didn't care for an in-depth critique of his performance right after leaving the media pressure cooker. So we began by complimenting the president on hitting the right tone and getting his message across on questions about what the government had been doing pre-9/11 to combat terrorism and Iraq. Then Dan tactfully broached the awkward response to the Dickerson question. We had to bring it up in the little time we knew we could hold the president's attention. "Yeah, I know," Bush said. "I kept thinking about what they wanted me to say, that it was a mistake to go into Iraq, and I'm not going to. It was the right decision." His tone was cocksure and matter-of-fact, not testy. I heard him assert such certitude about the decision often in casual conversation. He felt pretty good about the performance that evening, despite stumbling on the Dickerson question. "I thought you were on the right track," I said, "when you mentioned how historians would look back and judge your decisions. All you needed to add was to say that you plan to stay focused on the future." "Yeah, that's right," Bush agreed. "All right, guys, thank you for your good work." And he headed around the corner in his usual swift manner to join the butler who was holding the elevator to his private residence above, followed by a Secret Service agent. There were many other times, in private and public, when the president defended the most fateful decision of his administration. But few will be remembered as vividly as the one he made that night. It became symbolic of a leader unable to acknowledge that he got it wrong, and unwilling to grow in office by learning from his mistake, too stubborn to change and grow. My knowledge of George W. Bush suggested several reasons for his inability to admit a serious mistake on his part. One was his fear of appearing weak. A more self-confident executive would be willing to acknowledge failure, to trust people's ability to forgive those who seek redemption for mistakes, and show a readiness to change. Another likely reason was the personal pain he would have suffered if he'd had to acknowledge that the war against Saddam might have been unnecessary. It would have been very difficult for anyone, much less the president, to confront the realization that his own decision was a mistake. An honest statement of the facts would have served Bush better, something like, "We now know that Saddam was a less serious threat than we believed. Still, the war was just and justified. Saddam was a brutal dictator, guilty of many crimes against humanity. He had an opportunity to come clean, but chose continued defiance. What is important now is that we continue to work together on a consensus way forward to a successful outcome, one we can all agree on. That is how we, here at home, will best serve our troops fighting abroad and honor the sacrifices that so many of them have made and are making." But Bush was not one to look back once a decision was made. Rather than suffer any sense of guilt and anguish, Bush chose not to go down the road of self-doubt or take on the difficult task of honest evaluation and reassessment. Rather than look back, he would always look forward, focused on the challenges of the future rather than the regrets of the past. That was especially true when it came to a decision as irrevocable and consequential as war in Iraq. But at times, Bush had no choice but to face those doubts. He believed one of his most important responsibilities as a wartime president was to visit the wounded and comfort the families of the fallen. He did so frequently, in Washington and during his travels around the country. I would shadow him in such settings. He visited the wounded at Walter Reed Army Medical Center a number of times. It was always moving to see the spirit and courage of those who had suffered terrible sacrifice, from traumatic head injuries to lost limbs. Most just wanted to return to Iraq to rejoin their band of brothers, though their injuries would prevent it. Modern-day medical care, thankfully, is able to save many more lives than in past wars. One of the most memorable images that stands out to me took place during one of the president's visits to Walter Reed. He would go from room to room, visiting with the wounded soldiers and their loved ones. I entered a room just ahead of him and stood by the doorway. The room was dimly lit. A young mom from Texas and her 7-year-old son were seated next to their husband and father. He sat upright in a wheelchair, motionless. His head was covered in white gauze and bandage from the top down to his eyes. He was clearly not aware of his surroundings. The brain injury was severe. The president entered just after me. He walked over to the mom and hugged her. He put his hand on the son's shoulder and told him, "Your dad is a very brave man." After visiting briefly, Bush turned back to the soldier, placed his hand gently on the wheelchair, bent down, and softly kissed the top of his head before whispering in his ear, "God bless you." Then he turned and walked toward the door. Looking straight ahead, he moved his right hand to wipe away a tear. In that moment, I could see the doubt in his eyes and the vivid realization of the irrevocable consequences of his decision. Many a time, I would see the president walk into a room or area where the family of a fallen soldier was gathered. He would hug the mom or wife. He would visit with them and the dads and children, listening to them share stories of their loved one. Often, a mom would look the president in the eye and say, "You finish the job. You make sure my son did not die in vain." These visits had a way of reinforcing the president's resolve to successfully complete the mission, to press ahead. The momentary doubt became, in the end, another reason for his unshakable determination. Still, another motive for Bush to avoid acknowledging mistakes was his determination to win the political game at virtually any cost. Bush was not about to give the establishment Washington media anything critics could use to damage him and his re-election effort. He knew that in today's political climate, if he admitted error on a consequential matter like the decision to go to war, partisan critics would seize on it and use it to tear him down. On this, he probably wasn't wrong, but I believe that embracing openness and forthrightness could have redeemed him, transcended partisanship, and brought together leaders of both parties to chart a consensus way forward on Iraq. It may not have been on Bush's exact terms or to his preferred way of achieving a successful outcome, but it would have served our country and those we asked to defend it a lot better. Finally, there was Bush's insistence on remaining true to his base. Wary of replicating any of his father's political errors, Bush feared that his conservative base would begin to fracture if he appeared to back away from his commitment to Iraq. Bush and Rove believe that the base wants a leader that is strong, decisive, and firm in his beliefs above all. Since holding the base and keeping it energized was an absolute must in their view, Bush's reluctance to admit error was at least understandable, if not wise. As far as Bush and his advisors, especially Karl Rove, were concerned, being open and forthright in such circumstances was a recipe for trouble. And perhaps they were right for the short term. In the long run, the president's inability to face the reality of his own decisions, as illustrated by that emblematic moment in the press conference, would become a large and steadily growing barrier between him and the American people. It would also help erode any remaining opportunity for bipartisanship and a diminution of the partisan warfare crippling Washington and the American political system. All happening while our men and women in uniform abroad could have used the opposite from Washington. But in May 2004, Bush and Rove were focused on the short term, the fall election. The president had promised himself that he would accomplish what his father had failed to do by winning a second term in office. And that meant operating continually in campaign mode, never explaining, never apologizing, never retreating. Unfortunately, that strategy also had less justifiable repercussions, never reflecting, never reconsidering, never compromising, especially not where Iraq was concerned. The first grave mistake of Bush's presidency was rushing toward military confrontation with Iraq. It took his presidency off course and greatly damaged his standing with the public. His second grave mistake was his virtual blindness about his first mistake and his unwillingness to sustain a bipartisan spirit during a time of war and change course when events demanded it. I imagine that my views about Iraq have evolved in parallel to those of many Americans. Before the invasion, I was uncertain about the necessity of waging a new kind of preemptive war. Few people like the idea of going to war. If we are attacked, of course, then we must respond forcefully. But Iraq was different. No attack was imminent. Iraq was not known to be involved in any attack on America, other than firing on our planes in the no-fly zone, and the threat was not urgent. But 9/11 had affected our thinking in a profound way. The shock and anger we all experienced left many of us resolving to avenge the attacks in any way necessary, and our quick military success in toppling the Taliban in Afghanistan solidified broad public support for the president and his administration. Trust in Bush and his tested advisors was extraordinarily high, and so was public deference toward their judgment. I shared that sense of deference. As a Texas loyalist who followed Bush to Washington with great hope and personal affection, and as a proud member of his administration, I was all too ready to give him and his highly experienced foreign policy advisors the benefit of the doubt on Iraq. Unfortunately, subsequent events have showed that our willingness to trust the judgments of Bush and his team was misplaced. Today, my views on Iraq probably still track those of most Americans. Although I've been forced to conclude that we should never have rushed to war in the first place, I want us to succeed. But that success should be defined with a consensus of bipartisan leaders who are focused on doing what is best for the nation. It's clear that our troops have been there too long and been called on, as have their families, to do far more than should have been required. We need to find a way, sooner rather than later, to significantly reduce our troop presence in the heart of Iraq so that our forces can focus on terrorist activity and rapid deployment to assist the Iraqis as necessary. My concern is the same as that of so many other Americans. What is the end game? Where is the light at the end of the tunnel? If more outside support is needed, we need to somehow build a broader coalition, perhaps under the auspices of the United Nations, perhaps with the help of a regional coalition of powers, so that other countries can help bear the burden. Can such a solution still be attained at this late date, with so many people and so much treasure already lost? I hope so. But sadly, it almost certainly will not be achieved by this president. His credibility with Americans and people around the world has been damaged by his refusal to talk honestly about his war and its cost. All he can do now is prepare to pass along the problem to his successor. It didn't have to be this way. Even after the initial mistake of rushing to war in Iraq had been made, the situation was far from irretrievable. But no one in the president's inner circle, myself included, had the wisdom or courage to press him to be more open and honest with the American people. Instead, throughout 2003 and 2004, as the bad news about Iraq slowly emerged, the president and top advisors clung to the belief that the war he had wagered his presidency on would somehow turn out right. As the trickle of bad news turned into a torrent, the president could only double down. In May 2004, the horrific pictures from Abu Ghraib prison surfaced, shaming many Americans and causing a worldwide revulsion that severely damaged our efforts to win the hearts and minds of people in the Muslim world. As the number of U.S. military dead and injured rose beyond expectations, we would reach the 1,000 killed mark shortly before the election, I watched the president grapple with the painful toll up close and in person during those private hospital visits and meetings with the families of the fallen. Just as Vietnam had come to haunt two administrations 40 years earlier, so Iraq haunted both the Bush presidency and George W. Bush the man. I saw time and again how the sight of a combat veteran gravely injured in battle, or the wife and child of a young soldier who would never come home again, caused Bush deep personal distress, even anguish. But the one reaction Bush would never allow himself was self-doubt. If anything, the painful moments he spent trying to comfort those who had lost loved ones in Iraq, losses caused ultimately by Bush's decision to go to war, only strengthened his determination to prove that the choice to invade had been the right one and that their sacrifice would be for a noble cause. There were moments of hope mixed in with the gloom. The official transfer of sovereignty to an interim Iraqi government on June 28, 2004, helped buoy American spirits. The transfer spoke to Bush's most heartfelt rationale for invading Iraq, to spread democracy in the Middle East, and bolstered the hope that despite its growing toll, the war in Iraq would ultimately seem both just and justified in the eyes of history. As the 2004 election campaign unfolded, and with it the hyper-partisan atmosphere that has become standard for a national election year, other issues took their turn in the spotlight, including the economy, the 9/11 Commission's investigation, a furious controversy over Bush's National Guard service back in the 1970s, and a debate over Bush's plan for providing prescription drug coverage to seniors under Medicare. But three core issues at the heart of the Iraq debate kept dogging Bush and his presidency: whether the rationale for war was deliberately misleading, whether the decision was right or worth it, even without WMD, and whether the administration's handling of the situation on the ground was satisfactory. The permanent campaign battle to manipulate public opinion and shape the narrative to our advantage over each would play a central role in determining the outcome of the election.
Chapter 12. Brushfire.
Meanwhile, as the chief rationale for our war in Iraq gradually unraveled against the backdrop of a looming presidential race, one piece of the Iraq drama continued to unfold. The story of how the identity of CIA agent Valerie Plame had been revealed as part of the growing partisan battle between the Bush administration and its critics on Capitol Hill and in the media. It was a saga that would increasingly come to affect me personally. Tuesday, September 30th, 2003, the day after I explicitly asserted that Karl Rove had not leaked classified national security information, Valerie Plame's identity, was a travel day. No White House briefing, just a gaggle aboard Air Force One en route from Andrews Air Force Base, where the world's best-known plane is based, to Chicago. The president was doing the usual VIP photo ops and speaking at a Bush-Cheney luncheon to raise money for the fast-approaching 2004 re-election campaign. Then he'd be meeting with area business leaders to highlight what he was doing to address economic concerns and help create jobs. About 8:30 p.m. the night before, the Justice Department had informed White House counsel Al Gonzalez that officials there had opened a criminal investigation into the Valerie Plame leak. The White House, he'd been told, should preserve all records that might be relevant. At Al's request, the department would send a formal letter to this effect on Tuesday. Al asked whether the White House needed to inform staff that evening or if it could wait until the morning. The Justice Department said morning would be fine. Since rumors of a criminal investigation had been circulating during the previous few days, I had been staying in close contact with Al and his deputy, David Leach, including the morning before I departed the White House with the president. I wanted to make sure I was up to date on any contacts from Justice, and I needed advice from Al and David about how to respond to questions from the press. Al informed the entire senior staff of the investigation shortly after 7:30 a.m. during our daily meeting, as we were all seated in our assigned leather chairs around the wooden conference table stretching the length of the Roosevelt Room. He instructed us to tell members of our respective staffs to preserve all materials that may be related to the leak, and said that the president has directed that we fully cooperate with this investigation. Al also said a memo to all White House staff would be emailed at 8:30 a.m. with specific instructions. Andy Card made it clear that the president wanted to get to the bottom of the matter and that staff should report relevant information to the Department of Justice. The room was eerily silent as all present listened intently to Al and Andy. The president and I chatted about this new development in the leak case that morning in the Oval, as well as during the short Marine One chopper flight from the south lawn of the White House to Andrews. The president, Dan Bartlett, and I all agreed that he should comment on the investigation now that we officially had been notified about it. During the gaggle on Air Force One, I updated the press pool about the Justice Department notification to Al. I had already spoken with some reporters earlier that morning before leaving the White House, and they had already been given a copy of the memo Al had sent to all staff. The press pool is a small group of journalists that covers the president when there is insufficient space for the entire press corps or when other logistical reasons require it. There are usually about 15 in the pool, and that is the number of seats they have on Air Force One. They sit in the far back left of the plane, directly behind a section for Secret Service agents. Three spots are reserved for the print wire services, including the AP, Reuters, and Bloomberg News. One spot is held for the rotating print pooler, who comes from one of the major newspapers on the beat. One spot is for a radio correspondent, and one for a news magazine journalist, from Time, Newsweek, U.S. News, or National Journal. One for a broadcast correspondent or producer. Two for the same network's camera person and sound person, and the rest for various still photographers. Anything they cover must be shared at the earliest possible time with the larger White House press corps. Based on what the president and I had agreed to early in the morning, I ended my opening comments to the pool by saying, "The president wants to get to the bottom of this as much as anyone and believes it should be pursued to the fullest extent, as I said yesterday. The president has always expressed his concern that leaking classified information is a serious matter and it should be taken very seriously. The president expects anyone in the administration to adhere to the highest standards of conduct." I added that the president believes anyone who has information relating to this investigation should report that information to the Department of Justice. Following the president's Chicago meeting, the unruly, elbowing mob of the combined White House and local press pool was escorted into the small room where a roundtable discussion